I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. Want to tell us your email password? How about your bank card PIN? You might as well, given the recent hacks of LinkedIn. More and more, passwords are too easy to hack, and that leaves many vulnerable to scammers. Today, Techsperts Justin and Dustin chat about password security and what you can do to protect your smartphone and other devices from hackers. Also, get a sneak preview at the latest gadget coming to a kitchen near you, a burrito printer. Join us on Up to Date, following this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. About 3 weeks ago, users learned that hackers had gained access to LinkedIn's databases when 6.5 million passwords were posted to an underground forum. Today, we'll get an update from our Techsperts, and we'll talk about password security, how safe those passwords are, and how you can make an educated guess about how carefully any company is handling your sensitive information. We'll also tell you about a new pair of sunglasses that allow you to record videos, the world's most powerful computer, and a new Retina display on the new MacBook Pro. The Techsperts are in the house, and they are Dustin Jacobson. He's Chief Strategy Officer at Flat Square Technology Group. Dustin, nice to have you.
Nice to be here.
As always. Justin Parlett is back, too. He's the Support Systems Administrator at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Dustin, good morning to you, too.
Hello.
Well, between LinkedIn, Zappos, and DreamHost, and other prominent sites recently hacked, online security is back in the news. But Dustin, what does it, you know, actually mean when one of these sites gets hacked, and how can folks protect themselves?
Well, the first thing, you know, that I always tell, you know, colleagues and friends and clients is that it's only going to be as secure as you make it. So all these organizations have put practices in place, as we found out here recently, some of them have not put as good of practices in place as they should have. But there's a few kind of general things that you can follow. The first thing is anytime that you use the same username and password across all your accounts, if one of those gets exposed for whatever reason, then all of a sudden that's exposed across the board.
Is it to all the other sites?
People can guess it.
Yeah.
Lot of times what you'll see is if an email address is posted with a password somewhere on the internet, it's very easy for that information to become available to everybody. Then all of a sudden, then you're like, oh, well, they had this username and this password. Let's just try it for all the big ones out there, for Amazon and, you know, whatnot.
Yeah.
And a lot of times, that's it. That's all that they need. So that is kind of the biggest one.
It is kind of a crazy world these days, though, because you need so many passwords and how you keep them straight, because the memory thing doesn't always memorize what your password is, so you're starting all over again.
Well, and even in that situation of the, you know, remember this password, on shared computers, then once again, that becomes an issue. Or if you, leave, place of employment, or, you know, you're using something at a school or your public library, then all of a sudden, then that information, a lot of people don't realize, you know, kind of stays with that device. So if you don't completely log out of a computer or delete your cookies or whatever, then that information stays with that device.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that people want to be pretty mindful of, especially since so many websites ask for an email address as your login, or they'll connect to your Facebook account. You just log in using Facebook. Well, if your Facebook account becomes compromised, well, now the other sites that you've used to log in with Facebook are now open as well.
Yeah. I just was struck that there are a number of ways a site can store your password, and some, as you're pointing out, Dustin, are considerably more secure than others. Let's walk through some of them. I mean, the simplest way a site can store your password is in plain text, right?
Right. And essentially what that means is that, you know, your password, you know, is 123. So they store it in their, you know, database systems and their back-end systems that say, you know, Dustin's password is 123. So when
it's he right
logs
there in plain
right there.
Writing.
So anyone that has access to that system, or can kind of track, you know, as traffic goes in between your computer and their computer, then that is not encrypted, meaning that they can look at, you know, there's a variety of different ways to do it. But you can basically eavesdrop on, hey, they're talking to Amazon and they're sending their password, and Dustin's password is, you know, 123. So even if I don't get access to their systems, if I'm sitting in a coffee shop and it's using an insecure connection, all of a sudden I know what that login information as well. Hmm. So that's kind of the first one, though, is that, and that's more meant if someone on the administrative side, someone working for that organization, has access to that system, they can easily look it up and see what your password
is. That's the worst possible method, right?
Yeah, that's
the least secure.
Yeah, and a lot of times, you know, as we kind of walk through these, what you'll see is small organizations, they'll just kind of throw something together like, oh yeah, we're going to sell this thing online now. Well, let's just make it real easy, or, you know, we want to make it as easy for us, the organization, as possible. So we don't want it to be, you know, like double secret, you know, encryption and all this kind of stuff. So that way, if a customer calls and say, hey, what's my password? Oh, well, let me look it up for you. And oh yeah, it's 123. Okay, great. So it's both for their convenience as well as just the simplicity of it.
To add more protection to your password than plain text provides, most sites encrypt your password before they store it on their servers. And what does that mean? Encryption.
Right. So it's, you know, if you were to gain access to the system, you couldn't easily see that it was just 123. They make it a little bit more complicated to figure out what that password was.
They put what other letters and numerals around it?
Yeah. So it's like, so instead of, you know, 123, all of a sudden it's A7G6, blah, 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 blah. So it's not quite as easy to just look at it and say, oh yeah, it's 123.
Okay. And then there's something called hashed, which is similar to encryption in the sense that it turns your password into a long string of letters and numbers to keep it hidden. However, unlike encryption, hashing is a one-way street. If you have the hash, you can't run the algorithm backwards and to get to the original password, right?
Right. And once again, this is where they're trying to make it even more difficult to figure out what that is, because it's basically comparing, you know, whatever your password is to whatever the stored version of that is. So you'd have to know how that's – the algorithm behind the scenes, and that's very difficult to do.
And then they're salting a hash, this fancy term. What does that mean? A little pepper too, probably.
Right. I mean – and. You know, the challenge with all these different approaches is now the technology has gotten so advanced that even the more complicated – it's the whole cat and mouse game, right? The more locks you add to the doors, the more ways that people figure out how to break down the doors or go through the window. So once again, it's another way where they're trying to figure out, okay, how can we make it more difficult to figure out by adding these different random, you know, letters and characters and numbers and such. But once again, the computers are so fast now that they can basically try all these different combinations of letters and numbers to decrypt that. So, you know, 10 years ago, your home computer couldn't do that, right? It was just like, oh, I can go on, you know, send some emails. You know, now our home computers can do this kind of stuff, and they can offload it to the cloud, and they can process it with these huge, gigantic computers. And they've also stored these different versions of this. So there's ways that you can use words out of books to try and guess what people's passwords are. And that's why you see all these weird requirements of it's got to have one uppercase and one, you know,
yes.
this, and, you
yes.
know, can't have your last 27 versions, and can't be your street address, and can't be password, and can't be all these things, because it's much easier for them to guess what your password is.
And finally, we'll end this sort of nonsensical streak here. The best option for storing passwords these days appears to be something called slower hashes. What is that?
You know, the thing here is that it's more difficult to hack it. So what they're trying to do is make it more difficult for users to figure out, so you can't just throw it out, you know, in a cloud somewhere and do it. So once again, it's making it more difficult for what's called brute force, where it's you're just going to throw, you know, a million different iterations of combinations of letters and numbers and everything in there until ultimately you hit the jackpot.
And get in.
But the way that a lot of organizations are combating this is that, you know, they're trying to limit the amount of failed logins from any individual location. So, and you'll see this. So if you try and, you know, log into Amazon, you know, whatever certain amount of times, or from a certain computer or whatever, they'll say, sorry, your account's been locked, or it's temporarily, you know, try again in 4 hours. And then if you try again, it still fails. You know, they lock it. There's a lot of different ways that companies are trying to keep that down for, you know, just onesie twosies. But if you hack the whole system and you get the whole database, that's a whole nother story.
Well, so Justin Parlett, if you're a consumer out there and you're already squeamish about sending social security numbers through the ether land of the internet or other sensitive information like that, what should you do to sort of get on top of this problem and protect yourself a little bit?
Well, there are a couple of things that users can do to make sure that their password maybe doesn't necessarily link. And the first thing, and this is it's going to sound very common sense, very smack on the forehead, duh, when I say this, but just don't use services that have bad security.
Well, how do you know that?
Well, there are a couple of different ways you can do that, actually. One thing that I find very helpful if I'm signing up for a service and I want to test just how easy their password encryption is to crack, I'll click on the I lost my password link. And if they just send me an email with that password in the email, then that means that they don't really have the password encrypted anywhere.
Oh, the same
that
means password it's, yeah. you've already used.
Yeah, that yeah. means it's a plain text password that's just stored on their server and they have access to
it. So ideally, they should send you a different set of numbers.
Or right. alternatively, they'll send you to a link where you just generate a new password after answering a couple of security questions. But mm-hmm. that's one quick thing that you as an end user can do to kind of test the security of a site. If you have questions about it, just, hey, I've lost my password, and then see what they send you.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one method. Another is to use a strong password, as we've been discussing. The longer the password, the better. And the more complicated you can make it, ideally probably the best.
Uppercase, lowercase,
uppercase,
numbers
lowercase,
and letters.
Phrases, yeah. you know, make it, you know, a really long, silly phrase like correct horse battery staple. Is a famous one.
Which one?
Correct horse battery staple. If you Google that, you'll find a very funny cartoon that's been going around on the internet for a long time.
Correct horse battery staple.
Yeah, use that as a password.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Why
so,
not?
I mean, just kind of a nonsensical term, something that's easy. So
longer is better.
Longer is better. The more complex it is, because you know a lot of people when they sit down to make a password, they just, I want to be able to remember it very easily.
Well, that's the issue.
Make it something absurd to you that will stick out in your mind, but maybe not necessarily, you know, a nickname. There was actually a very interesting piece on NPR this morning talking about password security, and one of the things they mentioned was some of the more common passwords are not necessarily things that we would think of, just like the word password, but they're nicknames like Princess.
Mm-hmm.
And Princess 22 or, you know, some yeah. sort of number like that. So, you know, try to avoid those things. With me, a lot of my friends call me JPAR. I will never, ever, ever have a password that involves my nickname.
Mm-hmm.
It's just – it uses sense. So use a strong password.
So hackers beware. Look out for Justin Parlett
yeah,
out there.
Not going to yeah. happen, buddies.
Dustin, what else would you recommend for users out there to be aware of?
Yeah, so there's a few services that everybody uses out there. You know, Google, Facebook are probably the biggest ones to various degrees. And those services allow you to do a couple important things and things that I have enabled and that I recommend most people to enable. And there's additional layers of security. The first one is that you can require HTTPS. You know, you see that in your browser with the little padlock or depending on your browser version. But you want to enforce that as much as you can. So what that means is that the traffic from your computer to their servers, wherever they are around the world, is encrypted. So at least no one just sitting next to you in the coffee shop, in theory, could eavesdrop on that conversation.
So you want to use HTTPS?
Yeah, as much as you can. And like Facebook used to allow you to make that an optional thing, but now they really require that.
I never do that anymore.
Yeah, so look for that. Look for the HTTPS. And usually if someone has that, then they've gone through the best practices anyway, so you're probably safe. But the other thing that I've enabled for all my accounts, such as you know Google and Facebook, is that it requires a second set of authentication. So if I'm using, say, a new computer, when hopefully I get my new Retina display here in the next day or two, that I'll have to verify that this is really me. So not just logging in from any random device around the world, but it looks at my history. Has he ever logged in from that computer or that IP address mm-hmm. or whatever before? And if I haven't, then it'll text me or I have to provide, you know, my mother's maiden name or whatever it is. There's different tiers for that. But it requires you to provide that other layer of security. So I can't just, you know, if someone does get access to my password and tries to log in from their computer, it won't let them and say, wait, are you really Dustin? Because you've never logged in from this computer before. You know, or this is coming from a different place. You know, they're logging in from, you know, from California. And we know you've been to California, but aren't there now because you just logged in from Kansas. So what's this? the deal. So, you know, all those different systems allow that, you know, require a known device or, you know, those kind of things. And that can go a long way. I've gotten notifications from Google that, hey, someone just tried to log in from your computer and we locked your account. It's like, whoa, okay, well, great. And you see companies like, you know, the credit card companies that have done that for a long time. Mm-hmm. If they see a suspected fraudulent charge, in fact, I got a call this morning. They said, you know, because of ordering computer stuff. And they said, hey, you know, is this legit? Is this really you? And that can go a long ways in really protecting your identity.
And after a breach, the experts say always change your password.
Yeah, and not just for that site, but if you share that same password for any other sites or usernames, change it everywhere because it's best practice.
You know, a listener wants to know, is there an app for my smartphone that serves as a bank vault for my passwords?
There are several of those. I have an app that I really enjoy. I've been using it for a few years now, both on my desktop computers and on my mobile devices. And it synchronizes between the two, which is spectacular because, you know, if I make a new password on my desktop, I want it on my smartphone.
Yeah.
It's an app called 1Password, and it's available for both Windows machines and Apple devices. And it's pretty stellar. I've enjoyed it. It uses
encryption.
And you can
store all your different passwords in there.
So the way that it works is I have one master password that is on that device, and the database containing all of my other passwords are in there. And so I can create my own password, or I can even have the application create a really insanely complicated 26-character password, and then it will just populate that into websites. So I don't use it for my banking site. I don't use it for everything. But if there are sites that I don't go to all the time, that's very handy. But again, it's not something that I would maybe use for my most important accounts because if, heaven forbid, that database is ever compromised, I don't want to lose that info.
Well, so say you're on a website. We'll just go to Amazon for a moment, and your password has been lost by Amazon. You click on, you have to go insert it again. Using this storage device you're talking about, this bank vault in a sense for your passwords, do you have to like type in all the different letters that goes on forever?
All I have to do is fire up the app, and there's a plugin, so it works within the web browser. So I've just got a little icon, and I tap on the icon. I type in 1Password to unlock the database, and then it knows that I'm on Amazon. So I just tap on Amazon, and it autofills that password for me and username.
Man, okay. Yeah.
It's very handy. But again, it's one of those cool tools that if you're using it the way that it's intended, can be great. But again, you do want to take a little bit of precaution with it.
We just put a link for 1Password on our website. We also have we'll post a cartoon strip about correct horse battery staple on our website, too, at kcur.org.
Yeah,
do you use that, the bank vault thing?
I use a very similar service called LastPass.
Mm-hmm. So LastPass?
Yeah, and it's just lastpass.com. And there's a variety of those, and I'm in the same boat as Justin. It's like there's only certain sites that I'll store that information because even, you know, I don't want all my eggs in one basket because, you know, those companies are really high-value targets because if you hack into those, then all of a sudden, boom,
the world opens up to
everything.
How do you know those sites are really well-protected?
Well, like for 1Password, that's an application. So that database exists on your computer. And if you want, if you sync it between devices, then it'll use a service like Dropbox or iCloud or their own server. Those you'll want to make sure are pretty secure. And then some of them are actual websites that have everything just completely online.
But still, is there a risk there?
No, there's always a risk.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing is going to be 100% airtight. But you can do the absolute best that you can to keep that information secure. I managed to go, you know, 20 years banking without having any sort of compromise. And then just in this last year, twice now, my bank account's been compromised.
Seriously?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's not completely foolproof. It's going to happen eventually to the best of us. But if you can take some safeguards, some best practices, that's better than doing nothing or using 1234, which is the same password to my luggage.
Right. Well, and you know, to go off that, you know, a lot of people are like, well, I'll just – you know, write it down on a piece of paper. Well, that piece of paper isn't any more secure, or, you know, remembering the passwords in your browser.
Right.
You know, if you don't have a password on your computer, someone just walks up, or, you know, you lose it at the airport, or you leave it in a taxi, and all of a sudden, you know, people have access to that. And a lot of people don't consider mobile phones security. So it's like, but most of that information is available from your mobile device as well. So they don't lock their phones.
And just going to say, most mobile devices now, I know both Android and iOS devices have the ability to password lock that phone. So whenever you want to do something on it, you have to enter a quick little password. Not a bad idea to enable that. But a lot of them will also actually have, you know, self-destruct features where if someone tries to incorrectly guess your password and it crosses a certain number of guesses, it will actually erase what's on that device.
Wow.
So there's some security settings that you can – some Mission Impossible style security settings that can help protect you.
Well, the Techsperts are in the house. We're talking about password security right now. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Our email address is uptodate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page or tweet us at KCUR UpToDate. The Techsperts are Dustin Jacobson and Justin Parlett. Let's go to some calls here. JR from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning, JR.
Good morning, all. Very good show this morning, and I hope that I'm doing everything right. On my smartphones, I'm doing, I think, everything that I can. I've got the open up the phone passcode. I'm using KeePass to store complex passwords, different one for every site. And, you know, kind of watch where I go. I don't use Facebook authentication, but I have started doing web business with one of the major sites. And I won't say who it is right now. And I've been using the passphrases more and more of late and trying to move into that, because even with the password management, it's sometimes hard to remember that you get everything right, and especially if you have to hand enter something for some reason.
Yeah.
But this major site only has 14 characters in their password. Where is the social force, the oomph, to make these guys change some things?
Well, JR, I give you an A grade for the precautions you're taking so far. Would you want to address that?
Yeah. Move to the head of the class. You're doing great.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be horribly concerned. I mean, yes, they do limit it to 14 characters, but I think it'd be important to find out what kind of authentication they use on the back end to encrypt and protect your password.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, our ATM PIN numbers are not 14 characters long, you know. They're usually much shorter than that, and those are, you know, relatively secure. So the length of the password isn't always your primary concern. So long as it's clever, so long as it's difficult to guess, and as long as they're keeping it protected on the other end.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things about those external services, whether it's an app or an online service, is that you know there is, in most of them at least I know, a way to randomly generate a password. So the nice thing about that is, once again, you have different passwords everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
If that information is stolen for whatever reason from, you know, that service where you logged in and created that password, the likelihood that they'll be able to crack it before you can change it is pretty minimal as well. So if you're generating a 14-character long that's mixed uppercase, lowercase, and symbols and all that stuff, yes, they can crack it eventually, but you're going to know a long time before that ever happens, because most companies now have to publish, or at least somebody will come out and say, hey, you know, LinkedIn got hacked, go change your password. And if you have a complicated password, you know, you're going to have plenty of time to go out to that site and change it.
Hmm. It's a complicated world, and the Techsperts are in the house. Robert from Kansas City, Missouri, you're on the air, Robert.
Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to, I think, probably reiterate some points that have earlier been made. I just tuned in about 10 minutes ago, but with security, the weakest link is always human beings. And I've tried to get friends, business associates, many folks to get on board and using some of these password managers. I use LastPass myself and have done for over 2 years now. But I even set it up for some people and they still don't use it. So it's hard to understand the human psychology aspect of the security issues and addressing them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and that's always going to be true. We've been told for decades now, wear sunscreen when you're going outside, and yet a lot of us still don't. So it's one of those things. I mean, I do.
Come on, man.
I burn like crazy.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you can try and help these people who are not interested in strong password security. But at the end of the day, you can only do so much. You can lead the horse to water, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
Yeah, the other thing I wanted to mention was two-factor authentication and biometric security. I think that two-factor is very important. I've used that on my LastPass account. I also use it on my Google security. But the biometrics also makes it easier because then you're using something that you actually have on you, whether it's your fingerprint, whether it's your eye print, whether it's some other form of biometric security. So it's easier. It helps with a human psychology barrier.
Is that the future of all of this, biometric security, you know, looking at your eyes, looking at your fingerprints, whatever it's going to be?
I mean, it's definitely easier. You see a lot of like IBM or ThinkPads, I think, have it built into a lot of their computers where you just scan your finger.
Yeah.
And I know that, you know, a lot of buildings have password security, you know, built into biometrics. So it is definitely easier. But, you know, once again, it's not foolproof. I know, like, with the fingerprint scan that the company used to work for, it was not foolproof. You know, if you didn't have your finger just right or, if, you know, whatever, then all of a sudden, or if someone had come in and, you know, just after lunch and their hands were greasy and wiped it, then it just smeared it for everybody and you had to wash it down. And so, you know, there were some challenges like that. It definitely does make it easier because you don't forget it, you don't lose it. But they're not 100% accurate either.
The moral here, we are all in big trouble. Let's go to Neil from Lawrence. Neil, you're on the program.
Hi, thanks for this good show. I agree with you, you know, certainly for the most part. And I'll tell you my practices. The one thing I do is the bank account, the information about retirement bank accounts and family matters changes on a regular basis. All the other stuff is a no-brainer. So I sort of think we have this pants on fire or hair on fire approach. Well, we don't need to worry about if we forget our password or whatever. You just reset it. If you do wrong by Amazon, they'll be right by you or Apple ID or whatever. I think we need to turn the volume down. I think we're getting crazy. Anybody who wants to get in is going to be able to get in anyway.
Yeah, good thoughts, Neil. I appreciate it. Blake from Overland Park. Blake, you're on Up to Date.
Yes, I actually have two things. I'm a tech manager for a company out of Grandview, Missouri, and I require almost 95% of them have iPhones, and I require every one of them to have the four-key lock on their phones.
Mm.
Then I also have the, and this comes standard with every iPhone, with the Mobile Me, is basically the remote detonation.
Yeah.
I can basically go in and wipe every phone, no matter where they are in the world, and then I can also track the phone.
Wow.
So long as they're connected.
So long as they're connected.
Have you ever done that before, Blake?
Yeah, I actually tracked my wife. My wife actually left her phone in a friend's car, and we hopped in ours and tracked it all the way to their house and said, yeah, we accidentally left our phone in your car. Can we get it? And,
wow.
And picked it up, and it was just fine. So, yeah, I've used it.
That story Great. Ended much better than I thought it was going to. I tracked my wife's phone.
Blake, thanks for the call. And there are virtual bounty hunters out there who will come in, swoop in, and help a company out, right?
Yes, there are. Lots of consultants who are helping set that up. And a lot of corporations, especially, I know something here at the university we're exploring is mobile device management,
mm-hmm.
which is like what he was talking about with iCloud, only to the next level.
Okay, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about some troubling reports about the Kindle Fire. We'll talk about Windows phones. We'll talk about some amazing summertime gadgets, including the burrito printer, and a whole lot more with our tech experts here today. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed Friday's conversation about vintage cars or our talk with balloon artists, you'll find them and all of our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, What's Killing Our Forests? And One Man's Work to Ensure the Survival of Champion Trees. This hour, we're talking with our tech experts, Dustin Jacobson, Chief Strategy Officer at Flat Square Technology Group, and Justin Parlett, Support Systems Administrator here at UMKC. Again, if you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888, and our email address, updated@kcur.org. Well, a new report says that Amazon had better hope that its upcoming second-generation Kindle Fire is a real crowd-pleaser, because interest in the original Fire appears to be fading fast. Dustin, what's the issue there?
Well, there's a couple different issues. The first one is it's just got a lot more competitive. So at that price point, you know, in that kind of $200 price point, there's a lot of companies now that are launching devices that compete with that. So that, I think, is kind of the first one. And I honestly, you can't really put that in the same boat as the higher-end devices. You know, like, you can't really compare a $200, $250 device to an iPad that is twice that. So it's kind of an unfair comparison. But a lot of people are like, well, I want to get a tablet. Well, how much do you want to spend? Well, you know, $200. Well, then you can't even really consider the iPad. You might be able to get a used one or a closeout or whatever. But but for the Kindle, you know, their challenge has been more people now want the apps, and it can do apps. But now more and more devices are coming out that can do more and more things. And that boundary area in between what a mobile phone can do, a tablet can do, and now an Ultrabook and a laptop and all those other things, it's starting to get a little bit more complicated.
You were mentioning a little bit ago about your new laptop. You're getting a new Apple with Retina display. What is that?
It's a really expensive piece of plastic and metal.
That's the world we live in.
So, you know, recently, you know, every year, you know, Apple comes out and announces the latest shiny, you know, gadgets and hardware. And then at some point they announce all the software as well, because they do both, kind of unique for that. Microsoft is trying to get back into that as Justin and I continually spar back and forth about that.
It's so cute to see them do it.
Yes, it is. But essentially what this is it's a laptop computer that has a better display than you've seen at the consumer level on ever. So, you know, they come out and they announce it. It's a very powerful device. You know,
how big is the screen?
It's a 15-inch screen. It's the one that most people probably get retails for $21.99 to start, and goes up from there.
As in $2,199.
As in 2000, yes, 100. So it's
a little better than I thought over at Flat Square Technology. Yeah.
Well, it is an investment, definitely. So it's funny that kind of this on the tail
of the
previous conversation about financial investments and sharing those decisions with your significant other and such. So even as an owner of a corporation, I still, I'm going to go out and buy this. And wait, how much is that? Because the computer that I bought for her a few months ago for my wife was only $500. So
you sent me some stats that show that the 13-inch MacBook Pro, that's the most popular by far in terms of size of display of the screen, as opposed to these big 17-inch jobs, which are hardly selling at all.
Right. That actually really surprised me. So the you know, Apple has you know, a variety of different sizes, 13-inch. They've got the Air that's also 11-inch. I thought the 15-inch would be more common than what it was. But yeah, as Justin's shaking his head, it's the 13-inch laptop is actually the most common. And it was roughly about 50% of Apple sales.
Well, why get a Retina display laptop with a screen that's only 13 inches wide, which isn't that big to really enjoy this high def?
Yeah, and the Retina doesn't come, the Retina only comes in 15 inch.
Ah, okay.
So, and the interesting thing too is, you know, the amount of power that thing is cranking in. So they took out some other parts and stuffed it in with battery because of that display obviously takes a lot more juice to run.
Hey, do you want a Retina display laptop, Justin?
Oh, eventually, yeah. I think it'll be.
This will become,
we'll all be using them. You know,
at some point here, pretty soon.
When the MacBook Air was first introduced, you know, what was that, 2008? 2007, 2008, you know, people said, well, wow, that's the thinnest laptop I've ever seen. And at the time I said, well, yeah, they're all going to do that. And now here we are. We've got a whole line of Ultrabooks. You know, mm-hmm. Dell is making them. Mm-hmm. They're all trying to crank out laptops that are that same level of thinness. So I think this is the same thing. In a few years, what Apple has branded Retina, and that's their trademark for it, that's what they call it, they're all going to be packing that many pixels into a display, and it'll be much cheaper. So,
your laptop's going to look better than real life here pretty soon.
Well, yeah, actually, it's funny. The laptop that Dustin ordered has, what, 5 million pixels?
Yeah, 5 million pixels.
Which is more than your 40-inch HD TV at home.
What does your laptop have when it comes to pixels?
Oh, I'm running the I'm running a 2009 13-inch MacBook Pro.
You're way behind.
So,
the curve.
Yeah, it's actually about time for this guy to be sold to someone else and for me to upgrade.
Yeah. Let's go to some phone calls here. Marguerite from Lawrence has a question about security. Marguerite, good morning.
Well, we are talking about the biometric future of
right.
security. And my question falls off another program that I heard more recently about 3D imaging. It could create, my concern would be that this would be thwarted rather early on by the making of a contact lens or a thumbprint glove that would be able to break into that securely. The security process of biometrics pretty easily.
3D yeah. imaging.
I think the biometric security actually has to get to the point where it works consistently for that to be like a real threat. But yeah, I could totally see that. I mean, we've all seen Mission Impossible, where he gets the little contact lens. I mean, or, you know, gosh, what was – we just saw the Avengers where they did a big biometric security thing. They basically just took the guy's eye. So – yeah, I mean, that's a little extreme. That's a little extreme.
To have my
spoiler alert. But yeah, it's biometrics is really interesting. But I think there, like you pointed out, a lot of flaws with it, and it's going to be part of a redundant system. I don't think that it's wise for anyone to rely entirely on one level of security, including biometrics.
Thank you.
Thank you, Marguerite. G1 from Warrensburg. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
I just wanted to know, how do you know if your password is compromised or not compromised?
That's a great question.
A lot of times there'll be a big news report, like with LinkedIn, mm-hmm. when their database was hacked. It was all over the news. And
read
LinkedIn,
the Kansas City Star, G1.
Yes.
Yeah.
LinkedIn also sent an email to their users. And with your bank account, you may notice the bank will either contact you or you'll notice some things that maybe you didn't buy showing up on a statement somewhere. They usually will report to you that the data has been compromised, or it will be all over the news, like when Sony had their huge fiasco a couple of years ago where they lost millions of credit card data. Mm-hmm. You know, that information was widely publicized in the news.
Yeah, and a lot of the public companies now, there's regulations that are in place or in process now that require them to notify their customers if that information has been compromised.
So make sure you have a current email address on file with the
and
group.
Phone number.
Yeah.
Good luck, G1. Thank you for the call.
Hey.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye. Parker from Kansas City, Missouri. Parker, you're on with our Techsperts. Good morning.
Hi, guys. I just wanted to comment. You were talking about the Kindle Fire and the competition coming out. Looks like Google's going to be coming out with their own tablet, 7-inch Nexus, with the fact that it's going to be like a 1280 by 720 display made by Asus. And it's supposed to be priced in the $199 range. Be a quad-core processor, 1 gig of RAM, 16 gigs of RAM, and then have the newest version of Android Jelly Bean, and it's supposed to be coming out towards the end of July.
Yeah, I just saw an announcement about that this morning, that they were going to reveal that tablet here in the next couple of days, and then it would be shipping in the middle of the summer, which is pretty exciting. It sounds like a power horse. I just hope that Google handles it better than they've handled previous hardware releases that they've put out, where it just, yay, this is our new hardware, it's amazing, and then 6 months later, we don't make it anymore.
Yeah.
Well, the cool thing is that it was going to be released by Asus in the MIMO 370T, and then all of a sudden, Asus backed out, and now Google's coming out. It looks like it's just going to be a pre-badged Asus tablet. But the interesting thing is it's going to have their latest version of Android operating system on it, and being the Nexus line, it should get its updates almost immediately. I just hope Google can support it. Hmm. But we should hear more about it at Google I.O. next week, too.
Yeah,
all right,
it sounds really cool.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks, guys.
Yeah, and one thing I'll add too is that even though you know the report is that Kindle's share, Amazon's kind of share essentially of that market, you know, it was closer to 17% in the holidays, and it's now dropped down to 4% the first quarter. So it looks like on paper, oh my gosh, there's not as much. But on the flip side, it's because the market has grown so much. Mm. So it's not like the Kindle necessarily is doing bad. It's that now as he just mentioned, Google's coming out with one, and obviously at the new iPad and everything else, there's so many different competitors now that it's they still have a big chunk of revenue from that device. It's just there's many more competitors in that space.
You sent me, Dustin, a picture of the internet from 1969. And it sort of was interesting to me. It didn't look so dramatically different on this woman's desk that I would have thought it might have looked.
Yeah, I mean, the concept of being able to buy stuff virtually and the concept there has not changed that much.
Yeah.
It's just that was black and white display, and so the way that is actually communicated has changed. But the idea about being able to buy stuff around the world and in real time, I think, has been around for a long, long time.
Yeah, we'll put a picture of that on our website, kcur.org. How about the 20 best iPhone, iPad games of 2012 so far? Is there a game or two, Justin, that's really standing out to you these days?
Well, actually, it's funny that you mention it because I'm actually not a huge gamer on my iPhone or my iPad,
now,
believe
I would
it or
guess
not.
Otherwise, Justin.
Everyone assumes that I'm a big game person, but if it's not SimCity, then I don't really it doesn't mean much to me. But there was on this list, out of the 20, there was one that I actually had purchased and was enjoying the heck out of, and it's called Epic Astro Story.
Astro Story.
It's a great little it's from a great little developer called Caresoft, and right now it's got a 4.5 star review on the App Store. It got a 92% from Metacritic, which is basically crowdsourced reviews. It's $3.99, and the thing that I really like about it is it's very playable. It's essentially SimCity. it's on my iPhone and my iPad. But then it also adds kind of some tower defense elements to it, where I have to fend off alien invasions as they try to destroy my city. And it combines some role-playing type stuff. So as I continue playing the game, I'm able to do more things. And it's fun. And that's what I think games on your portable device should be, just fun little things that you can pick up when you've got a couple of free minutes.
Dustin, what's your favorite game so far of 2012?
There was one that was in that list that I actually went out and investigated some more, and it's called Puzzle Juice. and it's interesting because it combines Tetris with Scrabble. So, basically you're trying to put – where you're trying to make your own words out of it, but you have to drop blocks to do that. And some of them have letters and some of them don't. So – once again, it's just kind of mind-numbing game like that. But I found that pretty interesting. It didn't have great reviews, but it had decent reviews. But once again, it's 99-cent kind of time killer while you're waiting for the bus or whatnot.
Well, speaking of great reviews, Microsoft's new Surface tablets have made a pretty good first impression. What do we know about that?
Nothing.
just what they showed us. And then
they haven't showed us much yet.
Yeah, they had a fun little presentation where Steve Ballmer came out and very unenthusiastically talked about this new tablet device.
Unenthusiastically?
Yeah, I mean, it was...
He didn't do the Steve Jobs thing where he was all fired up.
No, none of the people on stage presenting this new tablet that's supposedly going to be the cornerstone of Microsoft over the next couple of years, none of them seemed all that excited about it. It was very boring to watch.
The point is Microsoft is in the tablet game
all
of a sudden.
Well, yes.
They're coming.
If they ship it, which they haven't told us when they're going to ship it, the Microsoft Surface, Surface. We don't know how much it's going to cost. There are two versions of it. It's an interesting device. They've got two versions of it. One version is basically trying to be just a tablet. The other version is trying to be a tablet computer, which Microsoft
actually has a fold-down keyboard. I think
it's weird. The coolest thing about the Surface to me is if you're familiar with Apple's iPad, you've seen the Smart Cover, where it's this little cover that folds off and it's kind of magnetic. Well, what Microsoft has done is they've one-upped it, and if this works and is as nice as it appears to be, I think it's going to blow Apple away as far as their Smart Cover is concerned, because it actually has a keyboard and a trackpad built in. Now, that's neat. The keyboard's cool. The trackpad, I feel, is a little redundant because it's a touch device. Why do you need a trackpad
too? Why would Microsoft unveil this product and yet not let folks like you try it out and give it a ride.
Because the version that they were demoing froze during their demonstration. Ooh. So I can only imagine what would happen if they let people play with the prototype.
Ooh.
I think they wanted to premiere this new device that they're
and
working on.
And get people
on,
like us talking.
And get people talking about it and excited about it. But it's not ready to actually get out into the hands of the general public. So they were very good about trying to pull an Apple where they didn't tell anyone about this. They said, come to check out our secret event. And then they showed everybody their tablet. But the difference is at the end of all the Apple events, you get to play with the device.
Yes.
And
go buy it.
You can go
money.
Buy it right away. You know exactly how much it's going to cost. You know what products are going to be available with it at launch. And there's just this kind of nebulous question cloud floating over the surface. Like, okay, it looks neat, but what's it going to actually be like when it ships?
So did Microsoft blow it then?
Well, you know, they're kind of. I mean, they got some great attention because obviously a lot of people picked it up. The challenge is they're saying it's going to be 4 to 6 months before you can get it. So you're going to, over that time period, lose your momentum. Whereas an Apple, it's like everyone gets excited about it. It's like, okay, now give me your money. And boom, it happens.
It keeps the buzz going.
It keeps it, right. So here there's a lot of unknowns. So for people to get really excited, they came out and said, oh, it has this, you know, same kind of Retina display that, you know, is in the iPad or whatever. It's like, okay, great. That's something to get excited about. They didn't announce really any details, price or whatever. There's also a lot of conflict with their channels because now you have Microsoft now creating hardware, and that's competing with, you know, Dell and everyone else that has computers. So that's challenging.
And it's going to be difficult for the developers because the two models are incompatible with each other.
Ooh.
They don't run the same operating system. So if you're developing for Android, for the most part, you know exactly what you're developing for. You know, if you make it for a Sprint phone, odds are it's going to be able to work on another device as well. With Apple's iOS, if you make it, you can run it on any of their iOS devices for the most part, maybe not some of the older ones. But this is odd because now developers have, okay, am I going to develop it for the version of Windows 8 on the, you know, Surface RT, or am I going to run it on the other one that uses Metro? So there's some confusion there in their development group, and I think that's a big problem. And as Steve Ballmer will tell you, developers are key.
Speaking of tablets, Zach from Kansas City, Missouri has a question about just that. Zach, good morning.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just a quick question. I'm in the market, possibly going to be getting a tablet. I have a home computer, and I just got a smartphone, the iPhone 4 regular. But as far as the tablets, I'm wondering, I know the iPhone feature has some where you can tap the screen 3 times and increase, you know, the magnification or the font of the things on the screen for like a visually impaired person. Do the tablets have anything like that, or is there anything coming down the road, I mean, to help people that are visually impaired with these, you know, newer and smaller devices?
Yeah. Lots of nodding of heads here, yes.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I know Android has some of those features built in. Apple also, when they announced the new Retina display, MacBook, announced iOS 6, which is the next iteration of their mobile operating system. And there are tons of handicap accessibility features in that that apply to iPod Touch, iPhone, and the iPad. And Android has some as well. But I do know that that's something that Apple focuses on pretty intensely.
Okay, great. Well, I'll keep that in mind when I'm looking. Thanks for taking
the call.
Good
luck, Zach. Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, let's turn to some gadgets and some great summertime gadgets. And what's this deal about a burrito printer, Dustin?
Well, actually, that one's Justin's topic.
Blame that on me.
I'm as excited about it, though, as he is.
Yeah, this is kind of fun. There's a guy named Marco, and I'm not going to try and butcher his last name.
Uh-oh.
I'm not going to try and butcher it, like Manrique or something like that.
You can sit at home, and you can print a burrito off your printer. That's what you're talking about here.
Not off your printer. I mean, this isn't sold just yet. But this comes out of a project at NYU, and Marco wanted to make a device that allowed you to sit at home and order a burrito. And then when you go to pick it up, it's pre-made and it's exactly how you want it. It's got everything. So basically,
when you pick it up, you mean you go in the kitchen or you go to the store?
You go to the store.
Okay,
like
he's developing this
for a store. And it will eventually, of course, be in the home.
But, see, I have a hard – we talked on this program about printing off a new bicycle once
well,
upon
it's,
a time.
I still can't
wrap my arms around that.
3D printing is basically you just print out parts. Instead of printing on paper, a 3D printer uses various cutting implements to actually create a object that you can interact with. I have a friend who makes lots of really cool cups and mugs, and he designs things, and it just kind of molds it out of plastic there.
And he prints them? You can print
them? Well, I mean, print. It basically sculpts it for you, but they're calling it 3D printing. because it's a, they figure that that's a very accessible way to think about it, right? Except maybe not.
Since it's three dimensional.
He said pointing at me. Yeah, I understand.
So what he's doing is he's calling this the burrito bot. And it's the burrito printer, where basically you tell it, these are the things that I want in my burrito, and it creates this for you in this machine. But I think the true application for this is going to be when we combine the burrito bot with the taco copter, and they join forces to make everyone's life infinitely easier.
Now, just quickly, I mentioned at the top of the show this idea of these new sunglasses that will allow you to video what you're seeing. What about that?
Well, yeah, so there's more and more technology. You know, Google's rumored to, you know, and announce varying degrees of things that allow you to augmented reality so you can actually overlay different things. And now they're starting to have that where, you know, a lot of the computers have, like, FaceTime built in or the video conferencing built in high definition. And now they're taking it one step further, which is now you can incorporate it into sunglasses, and at some point, you know, it's going to be contacts, and at some point just going to be in your brain somewhere. But it allows you to create more and more ways of content and then storing it for later use. And at some point it'll be, you know, broadcast live from your glasses. Not quite there yet. I'd have to go through your cell phone, but you can stream live from your cell phone, so it's not that far away.
Just real quickly, give us your gadgets of the month. Justin, why don't you go first?
Well, mine was the burrito printer.
Yeah. So, how could it not be?
I'm so tickled by this thing. It's great.
Well, yeah, and mine isn't so much a gadget, but it's what got me most excited, which is IBM came out with what's now the fastest computer in the world. And it has
I can figure out all my passcodes in about 12 seconds. Yeah.
Well, and it's like twice as fast as the previous one. Very amazing stuff. It's kind of mind blowing. But you know, one of the real applications. You know, everyone talks about all these super fast computers, but you know, to understand the drug interactions on the heart, a one petaflop computer would take about 2 years for that simulation. Which is still a super fast computer. This one can do it now in a few hours. So,
man.
Yes.
And there are pictures you showed me, too.
Pictures.
We'll
yep.
try and get those on our website
it's
as
very
well,
pretty.
KCUR.org. Justin and Dustin, thanks so much, guys.
Thank you.
They are our tech experts, Dustin Jacobson and Justin Parlett. You can learn a whole lot more about them on and about our show as well at KCUR.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Tomorrow on the program, a look at a little beetle that's destroyed millions of forest acres and one man's plan to save the champion trees. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.